And we're back. On to Best Actress, Brian.
So, Sean, can I say, our last series, which we completed at the end of 2018, was looking at the Best Actresses of 1987, the nominees.
Oh, yeah, it was.
Yes, it was. This was your inspired idea.
Thank you. Kudos to you. Thank you.
Yeah. Can I just ask, what was it about the 1987 Best Actress lineup that said to you, Brian, Sean, this is worth devoting an entire series?
I'll tell you why, Brian. Okay, why? It was the quality of women involved, of the legendary status of each, plus a completely random one at the end.
Sally Kirkland.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were legendary women doing roles that were kind of exactly matched for their talents. Arguably, they were all great in their own way. I mean, even Ironweed, I think we decided, was a showcase for a lot of things Meryl does best. Yeah.
I can see that now.
And arguably, I think other Oscar, you know, aficionados would agree, 1987 is up there with some of the best ever Oscar lineups. Yeah? For Best Actress. 1950 being the classic example, where it's just impossible to choose. I'm going to say it. I'm sure some other people have said it. The films of 2018 are one of the best actress Oscar lineups ever.
Wow, ever.
Think about it, Sean. Okay, we've got the list in front of us, people. We've written it down. Are any of these women a conventionally pretty ingenue?
Absolutely not.
Are any of these women from a bad movie? Yes, one of them. Mm-hmm. The movie is bad, we'll get to that. But is that person herself, even though the movie might be bad, you know, worthy of recognition, of not being ignored?
I don't know what you're saying about Olivia Colman.
What I'm saying is, here we have some of the best actresses working, who are not always the kinds of people who get recognized. And we have a pop star.
Megastar.
Pop megastar making her very credible, you know, major acting debut. And then we have an unknown who also represents the first indigenous woman ever to be nominated for an Oscar.
Let's just acknowledge that for a moment.
I mean, that's incredible.
Insanely brilliant, I should say.
Yeah. But I'm just saying, you look at these five, and I'm going to be honest with you, if any of them won, I would probably be fine with it.
Yeah, so would I. I genuinely would.
And how often can you say that?
Very, 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 very rarely.
Yeah, so that's incredible.
And how many of them are naturally blonde as well?
That's a question we'd...
Actually, none of them.
Yeah, probably. I mean, it depends on how you define blonde.
That's
probably
good.
And also, there's been a trend recently toward older actresses, you know, dominating in the Best Actress category. I don't know if that's because baby boomers are aging or what the story is, but, like, for a long time, your classic Best Actress winner was your sort of 30, 28-year-old, 32-year-old actress. And that trend has been breaking with a lot of recent winners. Our most recent winner was Frances McDormand. We've had, you know,
Julianne Moore,
Cate Blanchett in recent years.
Yeah, we've also had Jennifer Lawrence and Brie Larson.
Yeah. No, I'm not saying...
Yeah, I know.
And Emma Stone. But I'm saying that, like, even if you look at those winners, their co-nominees in those years were not all kind of, you know, pretty young things. So this is a good sign for the Oscars.
Yeah.
Do we want to just remind our listeners who the nominated women are?
I'd love to, Brian.
¿Qué? ¿No me vas a hablar?
No puedo. Estoy muerto.
Entonces resucita, pues, y ya nos vamos.
No puedo. Estoy muerto.
Ah, bueno.
Good night, ladies. Ladies, good night. It's time to say goodbye.
Like, almost every single person that I've come in contact with in the music industry has told me that my nose is too big and that I won't make it.
Your nose is beautiful.
They were all staring, weren't they? I can tell even if I can't see, and I heard the word fat, and ugly.
Caustic wit is my religion.
I can't carry it off. You certainly can.
Doesn't help too much in the relationship department.
Joe, please don't thank me in your speech.
What?
I don't want to be thought of as the long-suffering wife. You understand that, don't you?
No. I have to thank you. Everyone thanks their wife. If I don't, I'll come off like some narcissistic bastard.
But you are.
very you're long time.
You're full of shit.
I'm not full of shit. Yeah, I'm telling you the truth.
Yeah, you're full of shit.
Can I touch your nose?
Oh, my gosh.
Are you happy that Gaga went with that as her screen credit? Or did you want her to be Stephanie Dunham?
Oh, I honestly... Do you know what I really, really thought was going to happen? And I was so disappointed. It's that I thought that come the end credits, it would say Bradley Cooper, Stephanie Germanotta, A Star Was Born.
I know, but it didn't.
It didn't, yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I know, but...
Did that disappoint you?
I initially, yes. I was very disappointed. When I saw her name on the posters and it was Lady Gaga, I'm wondering if there was... conversation in some
well, here's the conversation.
Office, air-conditioned room.
I mean, if the posters had said Stephanie Germanotta, yes, the little monsters would have known. But, like, a lot of people wouldn't even have known that was her, because she just was, like, a general, you know, brunette girl on the poster. Like, most people don't know what Lady Gaga looks like, because she looked different all the time.
But that knows.
I just wanted to take another look at you. Okay, we're not doing Lady Gaga first. We have an order. Okay. Perhaps because of its historic nature, shall we begin talking about Yalitza Aparicio?
Yes, please.
Yes, as Cleo. Our podcast buddy, Michael Schulman, had the pleasure of meeting her for a Talk of the Town piece in The New Yorker.
Yeah, our subscription has lapsed.
Our subscription has lapsed.
Yeah, but only because we spent a lot of money recently.
Contribute to our Patreon account and we can read what Michael said about Yalitza. Yalitza? Because we can't even look at it on the internet because I've already looked at too many articles for the month. So, sorry. No, I actually have learned a bit about Yalitza. She's 26.
Wow.
Do you believe that?
Well, yeah, of course I believe that.
Now, here's a great story. Okay, so
why would she lie?
She's 26. She wasn't even planning to audition the film. Her friend was going to audition, or maybe her sister, some other person.
I love those stories.
Yeah. Her sister was going to audition, but for some reason couldn't make it. So she sent Yalitza along instead.
That's not how auditions work, hon.
No, what I'm saying is, like, she sent her along because she's like, I'm going to miss this opportunity, but I at least want to know what it's like.
Oh, yeah, that's nice.
So she went along. Went through all the auditions, and she didn't meet Alfonso Cuarón till, like, the fourth round. And at that point, she had no idea who Alfonso Cuarón was.
Wow.
She'd never acted. She's trained as a primary school teacher. Her mother is actually a domestic worker. She comes from an indigenous Mexican background. And now she's nominated for an Oscar. She's also been on the cover of Mexican Vogue as the first indigenous woman ever to be on the cover.
Can we just please again acknowledge the milestones that have been accomplished here?
It's incredible. Well, also, I mean, the milestones of her performance, which obviously we can talk about. I was reading that, you know, she didn't know a lot about Cuarón. He directed the film. He actually didn't, like, give her the full script. He would give it to her piecemeal. So that, and they filmed it in chronological order, so she's kind of like experiencing Cleo's experiences as it went along.
Well, that's brilliant.
That's really
good for someone who's kind of green when it comes to acting.
It's apparently a technique that Ken Loach or some other kind of people who often work with non-actors use. Anyway, all that is the background. The film is Roma. This is her performance. I have to admit, I didn't necessarily expect her to be nominated. I obviously knew the film was going to be rewarded. Her getting nominated and Marina de Tavira getting nominated is a clear sign that people have just responded emotionally and aesthetically to Roma, right? It is an incredible performance. It's a very different performance, I would say, than the other four. The thing with Yalitza as Cleo is that she's asked to carry a film. I mean, she really feels like she's carrying so much. She's carrying a lot of responsibility. She seems both young and innocent and wise and mature at the same time. Does that make sense? In her performance?
Well, of course, because actually you think of it this way. In the household, the domestic servant has a huge amount of responsibility for making sure that everything is as it is, but that's considered to be kind of menial.
Mm-hmm.
When actually the whole family dynamic hinges on the service that she provides. So, yeah, I completely believe that.
It's a quiet and recessive performance. It's an unusual performance to be at the center of a film because, I mean, there are emotionally wrenching moments, right? I mean, we can think of them. Are we giving spoilers for Roma? Can we talk about it?
Listen, people who tune into this podcast,
they probably seen
the movies. They should, and if they haven't, then too bad. Turn it off.
Okay.
Now, well,
there's an emotionally wrenching high point for me in the movie when I was in absolute tears involving her pregnancy and the loss of her child. There's a later kind of, you know, climax of when she saves the children of the family at the beach. Those are these kind of two standout scenes. But then when you think of her performance, it's mostly these kind of quiet moments of doing things like having to sit quietly while things are going on around her.
Yeah.
It's things like having to wake up the children and prepare things for them, having to like repress some of her feelings and anxieties and emotions while she listens to, you know, the mother of the house tell her the things she has to do, or the mother's own emotions.
Like, yeah.
Marina de Tavera is much more melodramatic in her, you know, drama with her husband.
Exactly, yeah. And, of course, Cleo also has to receive the abuse from her employer as well, because even though, yes, she's paid to work there and she has a place in the family, she also cannot talk back to the woman who was, like, yelling at her.
She has to do that thing where she's, like, navigating difficult waters, you know? You know, it's touching when she goes into the children's bedrooms and kisses them and they say nice things and she wakes them up and she gets them dressed.
And when they sing lullabies in her indigenous language.
Yeah. She also has to, like, walk a very fine line with her fucking gorgeous but horrible, toxically terrible boyfriend.
Oh my God.
So
that was really devastating because
he was so sexy.
He was so sexy, but he was just not a good person. Like, and I was like, by the end of it, I was thinking, no, midway through the film, I was like, I can come out of this film and still like this guy. He's gonna turn around.
Nope.
He's terrible. But I love full frontal male nudity.
And it was early on as well. We'd met him. He was in that cute, tight-fitting t-shirt.
Oh my God, he was so sexy.
But then we saw it all.
Yeah.
And she, actually, that's one of my favorite bits of her performance, is that shot. So we've seen him doing the thing.
Shot.
But the shot of her
sitting in the bed.
Yeah, just appreciating his entire form and his pendulous member.
Yeah.
She has this face on, which is like a face of sensuality, but also of kind of like thinking, this man is ridiculous.
Yeah.
He's doing this martial arts, and I kind of find it ludicrous. But again, I'm going to kind of hold my tongue, because I did enjoy that, but my God. Or maybe she didn't enjoy it. Maybe he's terrible in bed.
Again, Brian, this is the part about being recessive, is that all these things happen around her, of which she must absorb them without comment.
So here's my question, Sean, because I have to admit, I saw Roma further back than you did. You've seen it more recently.
Yeah, we both saw it in the cinema, because that's the kind of people that we are.
We did. We went, we saw it with the whole, you know, surround sound, all the thing.
It was so gorgeous.
Beautiful
cinematic experience. Can I just say something for a second? When I know I'm going to be hearing a lot about a film for a long time, I tend to switch off.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't want to get my opinion made for me before I get a chance to form it. So I knew Roma was good, I knew it was from Alfonso Cuarón, who I keep mixing up with Alejandro Iñárritu.
No!
And the reason why...
It's because you haven't seen Children of Men, that's why.
Well, here's the thing. I don't particularly care for Alejandro Iñárritu. Okay, I don't particularly care for him. So I have to remind myself that they're not the same person.
They're clearly not. If you watch their films, one is a kind of, you know, up his own ass narcissist, and the other is a beautiful humanist.
Who also made The Little Princess.
I know, made The Little Princess, made the third Harry Potter movie, and made Children of Men, which honestly I'm inclined to make you watch tonight because it's so good.
Okay.
Gravity is fine.
I like Gravity a lot.
Do you? We've never actually talked about Gravity.
Well, you know, I saw Gravity on a date, and I was high when I went to see it.
There you go.
And the guy who was like, I'm so anti-drugs, all kinds. And I just didn't tell him that I was high when I saw it.
You know, I was high when I saw Philomena that year. Just kidding. That was a joke. Anyway, back to Yalitza. So I was saying...
Well, that might have been the year where you were high a lot, was it?
Hold on, listen to me. I get high now in order to avoid moments like this with you. Hey, listen to me. What was I saying?
Yalitza.
Pendulous members. Here's what I was trying to say. When I walked out of the film, I was blown away by it aesthetically. I had definitely cried. I had enjoyed all the thinking the film made me do the incredible mise-en-scène of the big shots, you know, the kind of epic scope, even for an intimate story. But I did have a question, which is, the character of Cleo, in some ways, is presented as a saint, as a martyr. She bears the weight of the world. You know, in that last shot in the beach, it's like she's literally being in...
It's like a reverse Pieta.
Yeah, in a halo of light. It's like, there is a way in which I wondered, is this cinematic valorization of this character in her suffering, is it making her more human, or is it turning her into just like an aesthetic work of art and denying her her full humanity?
You mean, like, is she just being beatified?
Is she being beatified and kind of just turned into a kind of a symbol rather than a full person? Now, I don't know that my mind falls one way or the other, and I think that has much more to do with Cuarón's direction than it does with Yalitza's performance, which is tender and loving and lived in and very, very natural.
Yeah, and complex and emotional. Yeah, yeah.
But what do you make of that?
Well, you know, I've thought about this myself, actually. Cuarón obviously made a film from his perspective of having a woman like this in his life. Like, I believe the person the film is dedicated to was the woman who looked after him. And so he's approaching this with the same sense of wonder and adoration for this person that mm-hmm. he would have always had. So it feels very true in terms of how the story is told, that he would consider her this way. But also, because we're not really permitted to enter her mind, nor are we permitted any insight into how she behaves when she's alone, or, like, you know, we're complete observers the entire time.
Yeah.
Like, is that to say that she is perfect, or is it to say that we just don't get that opportunity?
Yeah.
She could easily be a flawed and complex and character. The only moment we really get that is when she says on the beach with the children who she's just saved, she kind of blurts out, "I didn't want her."
Yeah.
Which is the baby that she lost, you know? Yeah. And we as audience members know why she didn't want that child.
To be honest, actually, now that I think about it, the moment that sort of stands out to me is maybe just a step too far in this, like, saintliness is, do you remember the scene where she goes to the village to track down Fermin?
Yeah.
And before she finds him, they're doing that weird martial arts ritual with the strange man from the television, the wrestler. And they're all trying to do the thing where they stand on the one leg with the thing. And no one, none of the strong men can do it, and only she can do it.
Wait, I totally missed that part.
Did she do it? You weren't paying attention. She did it alone of everyone. She could do it.
Okay.
Now,
so incidental, but actually...
But it's like kind of saying, like, I understand it's saying, like, she has strength and maybe also she's this kind of almost supernatural figure. But I just could have done without a couple of those moments, and also the moment on the beach that just kind of said, can she just be a real woman and not a kind of, like, saint?
Yeah, but here's the thing. In her role and her level of responsibility to that family and the lack of agency that she has being a domestic servant is that she's kind of forced to be the savior. The savior is a person who saves without expecting compensation or reward, okay? And the thing is that, yes, in many ways, she lives without compensation and reward because she's not entitled to it.
Mm.
But also because the people who she saves would never consider rewarding her.
Well, so, I mean, that's, like, what's so ironically sad about, like, when they come home the whole beach...
Like, it's like, says, Cleo saved us. Cleo, can I have some ice cream?
Yeah.
That devastated me, yeah.
No, and the movie is an extraordinary work. She's incredible in kind of balancing her strength and her vulnerability. And also, there's humor. There's humor throughout. I mean, actually, I'm remembering now also, do you remember when she gets abandoned by Fermin at the movie theater?
Oh.
Like, they've had this lovely date, and she tells him about the pregnancy.
And he's like, that's great, isn't it?
It's great. I've just got to step out to go to the restroom or something. And he's left his
jacket.
And just the sense of her as she walks out of the cinema and has no idea where she is and she's in where he is. And she's in this kind of chaos of Mexico City life. And you just feel, you know, she knows, I never should have told him this. Yeah, it's that sense of kind of being at sea. She captures it beautifully. It's a beautiful performance. It's amazing that she's nominated for an Oscar. Before we move on to anyone else, do you think she'll ever be in a movie again? Would you like to see her in a movie again?
Yeah, absolutely. I just don't know what she would want to do.
Presumably, it would be a Mexican.
Yeah.
Apparently, actually, she had to learn the indigenous language. It's the language her family spoke, but she didn't know it. She wasn't fluent in it, so she's a Spanish speaker. All right, well, that's Yalitza. I think, Sean, you want to move from the lowly domestic servants up to the highest level of royalty as we talk about the next nominee, Olivia Colman, as Queen Anne.
Oh, sure, that reminds me.
What?
When it comes to this category, they're going to be like, a lowly servant, the Queen of England, a wife, a legendary singer, and
a forgerer dyke.
I hate when they do that. Okay?
I know.
That is one of the most cliche things they do time and time again.
Yeah, it's always, I suspect there's probably never been an Oscar ceremony where they don't at least do that once.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, it's like they've run out of ideas and whoever the copywriters are just come up with that. But here we are, Queen Anne. I have a question for you. Did you know anything about Queen Anne before you saw The Favourite?
Nope.
Okay, nothing at all.
I knew there was a queen called Anne.
Queen Anne's lace, you've heard of it? Here's another question for you. Is Olivia Colman in the right category?
Oh, here we go.
No, honestly, I think this is important.
Yeah, I think every one of those actresses should be in this category.
In the category of lead.
What I mean is that I'm not saying they all should be nominated. They all should have been put in the category of lead.
That's interesting. It's really hard to think of a film that has three leads.
Yeah, but here's the thing. In terms of hierarchy, it does
Crimes
make
of the heart.
It does
Crimes
make
of the heart, yeah, anyone?
It does make sense that she is the one who's been nominated because she is like the whole film hinges on her.
Yes, and
or rather, it spins on her.
It's interesting. I remember because we saw The Favourite on New Year's Day.
I was also high when I saw that.
Oh,
but I didn't tell you.
God, you didn't tell me.
I told you after.
How did I miss it? What was I stepped out of the room? Anyway, we went to see it on New Year's Day, and when we walked out, I did say. They're all great. I would say the lead is Rachel Weisz. Arguably, Olivia Colman, of the three of them, is supporting. She probably has the least screen time. I don't know if anyone's actually tracked that. But the other two are doing things, and she's kind of responding to what they're doing. Do you know what I mean? I guarantee you, if they had put her in the supporting actress category, she would have won.
Uh-huh.
Like, don't you think?
Yeah.
With a role that kind of showy and mercurial and interesting. Well, okay, I know categorization is, to some extent, it is subjective, and there's no way that they were going to put all three women in one category. But here we have Olivia Colman elevated to the lead. She won, didn't she win Best Actress at Venice or somewhere like that? And she's won a bunch of critics' prizes.
She's won too many for me to keep up with them.
Okay, Olivia Colman, Sean... Have you liked her before?
I've liked her for years and years.
When
and
was
years.
Your first Olivia Colman exposure?
I mean, she was in an ad for car insurance, I think. They say things like, Ted, Bev, Ted. That's not their names, but it's something like that. Where she plays two people in one ad. The range. So there was that.
Was this a famous ad?
It's on TV for flipping ages.
I can find it if I look on YouTube.
You can easily find it. Okay. Yeah, trust me. So, and actually, just play a little bit of it right now. Bev!
Kev! Bev!
Kev? Bev?
Kev?
Bev! Kev!
With an AA car loan, the typical rate is just 6.2% APR, so you might surprise yourself with what you can afford.
Nice car.
Thanks! We used to have one of those.
To get more car for your money, call the AA on 0800 374.
Great, so there, that's proof that it exists. Following that, I loved her in that Mitchell and Webb look.
Before, I don't know what that is. I've never heard of this.
You know David Mitchell?
Yeah.
Hey, baby, you wouldn't know any of this
Wasn't
stuff.
She on Peep Show?
She was. But
I don't know what that is either.
I
just know
barely watched Peep Show.
Okay.
So that also was with David Mitchell and Robert Webb, although was on a different channel.
Is he married to Victoria Coren Mitchell?
Yes.
Okay, that's so interesting, because she was one of the first guests on Victoria Coren Mitchell's Riding in Cars with Women, or whatever that show is on Radio 4. Like,
Women Talking About Cars.
Women Talking About Cars, that's it. That was great. No, she was such a lively interview with Victoria Coren Mitchell.
You know, I will totally download that and listen to it. That Mitchell and Webb look was a sketch comedy show. So I've seen her in that. I saw her in the film Hyde Park on Hudson. We can't talk about that.
When we also can't talk about The Iron Lady, in which she plays...
Carol Thatcher,
yes.
I almost always say Carol Churchill. Can you believe that? Every time it's one of
Never!
Their, every time it's one of their names, either of them, I'll go, Carol Churchill.
Well, can I say, first of all, how often do you talk about Carol Thatcher? But secondly, I mean... If anyone is a critic of Margaret Thatcher, it is Carol Churchill. So really, your tongue should be cut
out. I'm sorry, babe. Okay, I can't help myself.
Okay. Anyway, back to Olivia Colman.
Yeah, so I'm so glad that she has been catapulted onto the world movie stage. Of course, because we both loved her in The Lobster.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've just loved her in every single thing she's been in. Whether I walk away from it thinking, God, Olivia Colman was great... or not. It's just, you know, she's consistently brilliant.
She's had, obviously, some big leading roles in films like Tyrannosaur, which I never saw.
Which I've never seen either, but I know it's very good.
TV shows like Broadchurch, which I've never seen. So
never even heard of it.
In a way, I have a lot of good... You've never heard of Broadchurch? I've had a lot of goodwill for Olivia Colman for a long time. You know, she's really made good on all that goodwill with this performance.
Yeah, and I am going to start watching The Crown when she comes into it.
And that's going to be the bit of The Crown, isn't it, where Margaret Thatcher comes into it?
Yeah, it's going to be Thatcher.
Who's playing Thatcher again? Someone exciting.
It's Gillian Anderson.
Do you think they're going to realize that, like, the woman playing Queen Elizabeth ends up playing the adult daughter of Carol Thatcher, and it's all just this, like, weird multiverse?
Yeah, and also, didn't she play What's-Her-Face in Hyde Park on Hudson?
Oh, yeah, so wouldn't
Which
she
Which I don't
be,
talk
like,
about for personal reasons.
But yes, we've already said that. So don't you think, like... That makes her both her own grandmother or own mother and the other woman's daughter.
Yes, it does.
This is what happens when there's such a small pool of actors who get playing the same parts.
Yeah, I want to know why Marianne Jean-Baptiste doesn't have a role in this. She's looking for work.
Who would she play? Diane Abbott, a young Diane Abbott.
I don't see how that would happen.
Actually, maybe they should do a... You know, why hasn't Novara Media done counter-programming of The Crown with, like... The history of labor from, like, Ramsay MacDonald through Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, you know, I think Navarra Media should get into, like, serialized stories on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't all have to be politics the entire time. I'd like a book on...
Factory workers.
Yeah, you know, maybe like a little romance or something.
Okay, but we're not going to talk about organized labor because we've actually got to talk about one of the monarchs in British history who is not as well known as the Tudors or the Windsors. This is Queen Anne, which is who Olivia Colman actually plays in this film. Now, we've said that we love Olivia Colman. Here she is, the center of everything, this queen in Regency England who is both physically disabled, emotionally distraught, possibly slightly mad, and
very, very sad.
Very sad and also kind of easily swayed like the wind.
I think I love this performance.
Yeah, tell me why.
I mean, Olivia Colman brings a massive amount of physicality to everything she's doing. Like, I do think that Emma and Rachel, as we've heard in the previous episode, they get a kind of a lot more things to do, places to go, that kind of stuff. And they often, I think they feel strangely more in control of the lines they're saying. Do you know what I mean by that? Which isn't to say that Olivia's not in control. What I mean is that Queen Anne very much reacts to things and says things that she feels need to be done out of kind of an intestinal urge.
Well, she's impulsive.
Yeah, she's impulsive.
Like, that clip that they keep showing or playing all the time is where that little page boy overhears the thing and she shouts at him, "Were you looking at me? Look at me! Why don't you look at me?" Like, she does that thing... I hate to say it's nearly Trumpian, which is like, I have absolute power, I am also almost infantile, or I at least seem infantile, and whatever comes into my head, I'm going to say. And I can switch from being completely ferocious to being completely pathetic. Indulgent, completely pathetic, completely sweet and charming. And it's a crazy mix of traits. And actually, in the hands of, I think, a lesser performer and not someone who brings so much goodwill, you might hate Queen Anne.
Well, that's the thing, yeah. She's not a monster in this film.
Not at all.
No, but she is monstrous in ways.
Mm-hmm.
And she's capable of, you know, obviously she commands armies and stuff.
Sort of, but
from her bed.
Well, she doesn't seem to know much about what's going on.
I mean, I know Liza made an album lying down, but... Queen Anne commanded fleets of military lying prone.
Do you have favorite memorable moments from Olivia Colman's performance?
So strangely, some of my performances are just the side profile of her face.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Because she, Olivia Colman, allowed her jowls to increase with this role.
Mm. I mean, she also does a brilliant job of kind of tracking minutely the progression of her illness, her gout.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of like limping and physical pain. And kind of then, isn't there a bit where it feels like she's maybe had some kind of a stroke?
Oh,
and
so yeah.
The way she does her face. And it's, what's interesting is mm-hmm. like oftentimes in certain performances that can seem very studied and like announcing the physical with neon lights. I'm thinking of things like, oh, I don't know, Margaret Thatcher undergoing dementia in The Iron Lady.
What do you mean neon lights?
Meaning saying like, look at the technical work that I'm doing. Pay attention to how accurate this is.
I was like, there's no club scene in The Iron Lady.
No. And there's only natural light in The Favourite. Yes, I know. I mean, metaphoric neon lights. Meaning saying, look here.
Yeah.
Pay attention to this minutely observed physical work that I'm doing. She plays the illness and the disability and the confusion like as a trait, as a character trait. So we notice it, but we don't necessarily need to have it like
addressed,
brought to the forefront.
Yeah, I do think that scene in which she wears that weird bodysuit, like the bodysuit itself is like so repulsive. You know what I mean? Like there's nothing flattering or helpful about it. It just serves to humiliate her further.
Yeah, the more we talk about it, actually, like, Olivia Colman's background as both a dramatic actress and as a comedian is really helpful here, because this is not the kind of Monarch performance that we've normally seen. Like, how many other Monarch roles do they puke up blue frosting cake into an urn? Do you know what I mean? How often are they fainting in Parliament? Do you remember that bit where she doesn't know what to do? It's just, she just collapses and faints. Or like being in a mud bath with the other two. Like, there's just a way in which this performance, this character, like, encompasses everything. She is the most powerful woman in the kingdom. Her literal word is law. But also, she's so incapacitated, so childish, that it's kind of this strange combination of absolute power and absolute lack of power at the same time.
Yeah. Here's the thing, actually. This is why I can get behind her as the lead. I just think in terms of the representation of the character and their significance, the film does hinge on her and her role.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to get into the nitty-gritty of why are those other two in supporting, but I don't begrudge her being the lead.
I think the comparison maybe most apt is with Frances McDormand in Fargo. Like,
very apt.
Essentially, Olivia Colman working with Yorgos Lanthimos and the screenwriters has created a character that now seems so singular. Like, this version of Queen Anne, I was in a debate with one of my playwriting students, the aforementioned people who didn't particularly like The Favourite, and she was just like, you know, Queen Anne was nothing like that. And I was like thinking, were you around at the time?
Yeah, were you around? No,
I don't call my students that, Sean. Thank you very much.
Oh, you can bleep that.
But what I'm saying is, maybe this is not the historical Queen Anne. I don't know. I'm sure some of this is embellished, right? I think the rabbits, for instance, was an invention of Yorgos Lanthimos and the screenwriter to try and like externalize this idea of how much she had lost. And it is bizarre and weird. But Olivia Colman has so created this very distinctive comic, tragic, grotesque version of this character that it's impossible to imagine anyone else playing this part. And like, while you could swap in, I don't know, a Lily James for Emma Stone or a Kate Winslet for Rachel Weisz, like, it really is hard to say who else could be this version of Queen Anne, because Olivia Colman just like owns it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? In the same way that Frances McDormand created that extraordinary police chief in Fargo, who actually isn't on screen all that much in Fargo, but is like the thing you remember most vividly from the movie.
Yeah.
You know? So kudos to you, Olivia Colman. She really is great, and I think in like any other year, she would be the real front runner.
You know, I just realized.
What?
This could have been Dawn French's Oscar nomination.
would Jennifer Saunders have played Lady Sarah?
I think in a different decade, that kind of would work.
Didn't they used to do a lot of movie parodies?
Oh my god, yeah. Have you seen their Bergman ones?
No, I've seen the Silence of the Lambs one.
Yeah.
That's really good. They should come out of retirement as a double act to do a parody of The Favourite.
Yeah, absolutely.
That would be genius.
It would be genius.
All right. From that, shall we move on to another lesbian drama?
Oh, please.
We have a lot of queer characters, and I think probably the one that seems closest to the queer lives that we've experienced is Can You Ever Forgive Me?, a film that both Sean and I saw in advance of its regular release at the London Film Festival.
Which we didn't then saw again.
Yeah, we liked it so much we went to see it again.
We said, Brian, let's go drink from the Well of Loneliness one more time.
We did say that. The nominated actress, as you all know, is Melissa McCarthy. This is a movie that so many people have such love for, and it's great that it has made it onto the Oscar shortlist in acting categories, in screenplay. You know, Sean, it's like, what is it about this movie? Because we didn't live in New York in the 1990s. We are not alcoholic, sad biographers.
Yes.
But somehow this movie... somehow this movie... It has a close-to-home quality where it's sort of adjacent to the lives we're actually leading. And in fact, Melissa McCarthy and Richard E. Grant first meet in a place that has particular personal associations with this podcast.
Yes, at that very bar, on that very seat in the center of the bar.
The bar is called?
Julius's.
Mm-hmm.
Where Jack and Lee meet.
Mm-hmm.
It's where we came up with the idea for this podcast.
Correct. Not the name.
Not the name. The name came up on... I came up with the name on my bed, I think. I don't think we lived together at the time.
I don't know. I think
it was in Clapham somewhere.
I think it was at Casbar in Clapham. Perhaps the only time you and I ever went to Casbar in Clapham.
There'll be a blue plaque outside that one day.
But it was definitely in Julius in the West Village on your first ever trip to New York City, where we were like, let's do a podcast. And we made the very first list of actresses that we were going to include. So, you know, great things come out of sitting in Julius. Either a cult podcast with dozens of listeners. Actually, no, hundreds of listeners. Or an incredibly, you know, devious scheme to create forgeries. It's the epicenter of the best laid plans of mice and men. You love this movie, Can You Ever Forgive Me?
Yeah, and when we went to see it a second time, that was kind of like me just checking that I loved it.
Yeah,
because
it was festival fever.
Well, I mean, I saw it at 8:45 in the morning, so that, you know, I would do it to you. But no, I do love it. I love it for... God, it's actually a very gentle film in terms of the story it's telling.
Mm-hmm.
Like, think of it this way. This is a story about forging Noel Coward letters.
Yeah, I know.
It shouldn't really be that exciting or enjoyable.
Well, and even when the crime plot gets ratcheted up, they do their best to, like, make you really care whether she's going to get arrested by the FBI and everything. But, like, who is the victim of her crimes? It's like, you know, people who've been a bit duped by not doing enough checking into the authenticity of some letters.
Let me correct that. It's wealthy people
who
buy letters. Okay? Let me just think. No real crime has been committed here. Yes, the easily duped have been duped.
And it's funny because I've mentioned my playwriting students already in this podcast, but I did have a discussion with a couple of them the other day because they had seen Can You Ever Give Me? And they loved it. But we were talking about from like a narrative standpoint that the stakes are actually quite low. And, you know, I know we talked about this with Beale Street as well, but there is this sense in which the plot is kind of inert, and yet it still works. Like, they begin this scheme together, and there actually aren't all that many escalations of the circumstances, but the reason the movie works so well is because we care so much about both these characters. It seems kind of like a caper. It's not a caper. It seems kind of like a buddy comedy.
Well, it's not.
They're not buddies. Like, even to the way that they're last seen together when, you know, he's leaving the bar and she says, I've just had the urge to trip you. Like, their dynamic is so... It's codependent.
Yeah.
And it's adversarial in a way. And you kind of sense, particularly from Richard E. Grant, that
he's
transactional and he can't be trusted. So that's part of the really interesting complexity of this film. Like, in many ways, on paper, it shouldn't work. And I remember seeing the trailer and thinking, oh, this movie's going to be dire. Like, it's not such a great trailer.
Yeah.
And the movie is such a sleeper hit because I think it just kind of sneaks up on you saying, why aren't more movies like this? Why aren't more movies this finely observed? Why don't more movies have such a great across-the-board supporting cast? You know, it's not just the two of them.
Oh, those New York actors. It's the great Michael Cyril Crichton, who we love
in yet another Oscar-nominated film, but also Steven Spinella, Anna Deavere Smith, Dolly Wells, who plays the bookstore clerk who goes on the, or she's the owner, I guess, it goes on the date with Melissa. Even Melissa McCarthy's own husband, isn't it? So it's really, really great across the board.
You know, this was one of the few times where I identified with a man in a film.
Richard E. Grant.
Mm-hmm.
I know that we're talking about actresses, but I also know you love Jack Hawk.
I just can't, like, I'm so thrilled that the male supporting category has someone who I'm so entirely behind.
Uh-huh.
The best thing about being on gay film Twitter is someone did a tweet recently, I think we may have retweeted it from the Broad Appeal account, being like, film scholars are going to look back at this picture and say, why didn't they both win? There's a little part of me that thinks that there might be an upset and that Richard will get...
I think that's the more likely win,
I mean,
of these two.
Melissa is not going to win, and that's partly because this kind of brilliant, understated, wry performance, even with that great scene in the courtroom, is just... It, you know, and also, unsympathetic characters tend to get a harder deal.
Well, especially for women. They have to be unsympathetic in a kind of more... Baroque way, like if they're serial killers or something.
Well, you know what else?
What?
It's like, we'll get onto this with Glenn, but it'll be... Glenn is the exact flip side of this performance.
Uh-huh.
You know?
What do you mean?
Well, she's pathetic in a very likable way.
As the wife.
Mm. Let's hang on there for a moment. But whereas Lee Israel, you know, she's pathetic in maybe ways that we identify with the worst aspects of ourselves. You don't want to spend time with her.
Yeah, and
I don't think I want to spend time with Israel.
And that's and that's to the movie's credit.
Yes.
And it's to the writing, and it's also to Melissa McCarthy's performance. When she sits down on that park bench with Anna Deavere Smith, you just sense that, like, they have this long and fraught history, and they are not getting back together. And it's very clear why, because Lee Israel would be a nightmare to be in a relationship with. She can barely maintain this very difficult friendship with Jack Hawk. She has terrible relationships with her agent, terrible relationships clearly with everyone else in the publishing industry based on her behavior at that party at the beginning, and with, like, the temp workers that she works with in her temp job, you know?
Yeah.
She's a self-saboteur. Like, she should be on that...
She's an outer saboteur.
Yeah, but she should be in that episode of Drag Race, the one where they all did that weird split screen where they play... It should have just been Melissa McCarthy
Miss
playing
Cracker every... Should have should have had Melissa as her...
Yeah. And, okay, so here's the thing about Melissa McCarthy. She makes this character so unlikable, but in a real way. Like, I have to say, for me, the film really hinged. It really sold me on the moment when they come into her house to deal with the flies.
Yeah.
The movie has been really enjoyable up until then, and she's this kind of person who you think, oh, I've seen movies like this. She's like a curmudgeon, right? Like, she's kind of a curmudgeon. She steals toilet roll from her agent's fancy party.
We've all done that.
You know, she just is a bit bitchy about other people. She's kind of, like, depressed and alcoholic, and this movie is going to be kind of about her getting herself out of her rut. You know, that's kind of the template. But then when they come into that apartment because she's been complaining about the flies, and you realize that the reason is because she's been allowing her cat's shit to just sit under her bed.
Yeah, and
so
also
long.
She hasn't been doing her dishes, and she hasn't been taking out her trash or anything like that.
But it's like the whole movie and her whole character have suddenly been reframed for us, because obviously we've been in that apartment with her for that first leg of the movie, and we've not quite picked up on how far gone she is into kind of social isolation and antisocial behavior. It seemed kind of maybe charming and funny, and then it seems at that moment kind of deeply vulnerable, and she's so sad and hurt that she's let these people into her apartment, and she's revealed this thing, and they've had such a disgusted reaction. Like, the exterminator has to, you know, run out of the room and say, I'll come back later.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, Jack also kind of gets gagged by this smell.
Mm-hmm.
And she initially gets really angry and she throws him out. And then, like, this is a testament to his character,
mm-hmm.
is that he knocks on the door and he says, Lee, I'll help you clean.
Yeah.
And I find that so sweet.
It is, and it's just genius because obviously you get the impression that he's been down and out, and he's been semi-homeless, and he's had to deal with a lot of stuff, and so in a way he's unflappable. Like, yeah. He can't be shocked.
This is why I think I identify with him.
It doesn't sentimentalize that dynamic in any way, because even though he helps her with that, he's then gonna fuck it up later when she takes this step to, like, allow him to stay, and he brings home that cute little waiter from the deli. You
love
him.
Talk about great casting.
Yeah.
Oh my god, that waiter, he's so sexy. And even, he has a little hole in his grandfather's shirt near his neck. And I just thought that, like, again, a testament to the costume.
If you get him, I'll take Fermin from Roma. We can go on a double date.
Fermin's going to fuck you up.
Yeah, so. That's fine. I have a history of that. We can go on a double date. Where do you want to go? Somewhere Mexican?
Let's go for some lox. Lox and cream cheese. What do you think?
Perfect. I'm sure Fermin would love it. But anyway, did you expect this performance from Melissa McCarthy?
Oh, I totally did, yeah.
Yeah? She's Why?
Because she's an incredibly capable actress. Even in bad things, she's still incredible. Like, she makes me want to watch Tammy and the Boss. Well, like, I will one day.
What are your favorite Melissa McCarthy's up until this point?
The Heat?
I know, I've actually never seen
I saw it on a plane.
You cried?
I cried watching it, yeah.
Is it, like, emotionally moving?
I think I was just a bit drunk too early in the morning. And
you were on a plane.
Cabin pressure. I loved Spy, here's the story. It was my birthday.
Yeah.
And I said, it's my birthday, so I decide what movie we're going to see. And we're going to go and see Spy.
Mm-hmm. And I acquiesced. I went along.
No, yeah, you acquiesced only after resisting, first of all.
In your memory, that's the case.
In my memory, you're like, oh no, why do I have to see this?
Babe, it was a Paul Feig movie who directed Bridesmaids, which I loved, which had not only Melissa McCarthy, but also Rose Byrne. So I don't think exactly I viewed it as torture.
And you know, I love...
I mean, I'm sure I wanted to see Persona or something. Carry on with your stereotyping.
Because you're the clever one, aren't you? I couldn't possibly make an artistic choice, could I?
You're the one who remembers the story in this way, not me. Yeah. I remember that we both went to see a fun movie, which we liked. And anyway, tell me about what you liked about Spy.
Well, I liked the scenes in which she was given fake IDs. Brian says, out of the whole film, the only part I ever mention and laugh at of Spy is Penny Morgan, an unemployed telemarketer from Ohio.
It is literally the only thing you remember. But I think Spy was an interesting one in Melissa McCarthy's career because she's still doing, like, kind of knockabout physical comedy, and it's very exaggerated. But you actually are kind of, like, emotionally invested in her as a person who you want to see her spy character's dreams be fulfilled, and her, like, crush on Jude Law and all that stuff is kind of, like, setting her up for a slightly more dramatic role. Because it's funny to me, with Bridesmaids, that nomination, that supporting nomination for Bridesmaids, is such an outlier.
So weird.
Like
she's great, I just don't think it should
She's great. Bridesmaids is obviously great. Like, yeah. If you asked me, Bridesmaids should have been, like, nominated across the board in a lot of categories.
Yeah, and I don't think I'd be wrong saying that you probably would think Rose Byrne should have got that Oscar nomination.
Yeah.
Like, if anyone was to get a supporting actress nomination, it probably should have been her.
Yeah, I guess. Or both of them, because, like, Melissa McCarthy, I suppose maybe she was just on the ascendant, because was she already in that TV show that I've never seen?
Yeah.
Mike and Molly? Which she won Emmys for, at least one Emmy, I think, at some point.
We don't know what we're talking about here, though.
This is American, you know, network sitcoms.
Is that like the Gilmore? No, isn't that like the Gilmore Girls? Wasn't she in that, too?
She was in that, but she just had a tiny role. Mike and Molly, she was, like, the lead.
I've
Molly.
Heard of it. No, I just don't,
it's like other things like Alice and Janney and
Mom. Oh,
it's like
God.
This is like another world. It might as well be Esperanto to me. But anyway, such a weird nomination. And I'm not disputing its quality. I'm just saying, like, the Academy never nominates performances like that.
But you know what? That Oscar nomination set up both the entire subsequent career and this Oscar nomination.
Yeah, so it's amazing because Melissa McCarthy is a short, heavyset woman, comedian, and she is one of the biggest, most beloved, most liked, bankable stars. And she can do everything from a movie like this to appearing as Sean Spicer on SNL.
Yeah.
And, like, what I think this movie revealed to me, if I maybe didn't know, I kind of only knew from interviews that I've heard with Melissa McCarthy, is that she's an actress before she is a comedian.
Yeah.
Do you agree with
me? Yeah, well, also, I do agree with you both in theory and in fact, because it was on Mark Maron where she said, I've actually only done stand-up once. And actually, I think he was kind of surprised by that, because mm-hmm. she strikes you as the kind of person who would have been on stage with cabaret style chairs.
Or like at a mic, because some of her early work is very like antagonistic, or she famous for kind of being aggressive. Like she, like that's like the Bridesmaid's kind of role, is this kind of like like kind of butch quality that she can have. And you would think, oh, she's honed that from years of being a stand-up,
exactly,
like fighting with audience members or something. But actually, she's this sweet woman, and in her story about doing stand-up, she said that the only time she could ever really make it work is when she decided to put on a costume and play a character.
Yeah.
And that reveals to me that she's more of a deep character thinker than she is like a comedian.
Hey, and she also knows how to make a dress.
Yeah,
because
she went to FIT.
I love that. Do you think Melissa McCarthy ever just like, she's at home and she just sews back on buttons and...
That I don't know.
I'd say so.
Well, you know, she and Olivia Colman are both these... And Yalitza, like, this is a great representation of, like, women who are non-traditional beauties, like, kind of getting their just desserts with these Oscar nominations. You know, Melissa McCarthy, the fact at all that she's a huge bankable star is just, like, a great sign
it's
for
a great,
the world.
It's a great thing.
Yeah. We got to say a bit more about Lee Israel. Were you the one who told me that originally Julianne Moore was being tapped
yes.
for this role? Listen, I love Julianne Moore. I think Julianne Moore is good in almost everything. I never saw Seventh Son. But do you know what I mean? Like, God, thank God we didn't get that version.
Thank God.
Why?
Julianne Moore would bring the Julianne quality to it.
Yeah.
And she probably would have brought kind of a seriousness to the character.
Or a derangedness?
I don't know about deranged, but like, I think she would have gone to the innermost depths of Lee Israel's soul.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think what Melissa McCarthy brings to it is very much in the way she stands and the way she reacts and the kind of the slight patter of anger the way she addresses everybody, which I think is a unique quality to her type of acting, which I don't think Julianne Moore has. And that's not to say one is better than the other.
Right.
I just think that in this role, I could not see anybody else.
You know, it's funny, when I was looking at the clips that I could find online to make that little montage at the beginning of this, I was trying to find ones where Lee Israel had a lot to say, and she doesn't. Even in that scene, like when she and Jack meet, he's a motormouth and he's saying all this stuff and she's just kind of giving these like through gritted teeth kind of barbs. Do you know what I mean? I think she's so beautifully conveying someone who has like put up a wall.
Oh yeah.
And kind of just lobs nasty little remarks and rejoinders at people a lot of the time. Like you can just imagine her like sullenly brooding on the side of so many book parties, like that one for Tom Clancy that she goes to, and just everybody kind of just being aware of this person who's on the side.
Is Tom Clancy alive or dead? Did he die recently?
Don't know, but he's certainly alive for many years. Neocon asshole, you know, like he really is. He just like, you know, propping up the Reaganite agenda with his red baiting spy thrillers.
Have you ever seen any of those movies?
Yeah, I saw Clear and Present Danger. There's a couple of them that are pretty good.
Jack Ryan, isn't he a Tom Clancy character?
Yeah, that's Tom Clancy, yeah.
Yeah.
To get back to Lee Israel, she's a recognizable type. And I mean, it's such a 70s movie, even though it's set in the 90s, like 70s stylistically. Do you know what I mean? Like, in just like, it has a quality of some of those great early Woody Allens or other things that are like observing this urban New York milieu. And I feel like you get that from all of Marielle Heller's choices in terms of the costuming. Like, the costuming in this movie should be nominated for an Oscar.
I mentioned that boy's hole in his grandfather's shirt.
Yeah. Or like Lee Israel's coat. The way she dresses when she goes to that party, and then she steals the other overcoat. Like, she's always had this bag or this coat, and then Jack Hawk with his scarves and his different thing. Like, the way that all of that is conveyed so subtly, or the very bookish people who work in all the antiquarian shops. Like, everything is note perfect, but I think it feels that way particularly because if you've lived in New York or you experienced that kind of New York cinema of the 70s, you know that kind of urban quality. I feel like I know people who are a bit like Lee Israel and Jack Hawk, and I'm thinking particularly of this woman that I worked for as an intern one summer whose name was Marcy. Have I ever told you about Marcy?
Yeah, you've told me about it, but also I'm sure she could hear this story.
I don't think she could, because I'm sure Marcy probably doesn't even have a smartphone and probably doesn't understand how podcasts work, because Marcy had been like trapped in the 70s as this like environmental activist. Her one goal was to stop the building of the West Side Highway, which she'd obviously lost because it got built. And she just was like, how I ended up as her intern, I don't know. But she had like, her office was like full of these newspaper clippings that I had to like organize. And there were just like piles of file folders all over the place. And she would have me like faxing angry letters to like Representative Gerald Nadler, like all the time. And every day she would, I would have 2 hours of peace in the office before she came in. And then she'd come in and she'd be just like eating cottage cheese out of like the same little container all the time. And she wore like what I can only describe as like a muumuu that was probably like 17 years old. What I'm saying is, there's a particular New York type of person. Maybe every city has this, but I feel like in New York, the characters are just brought out stronger, which is like people who are kind of on the margins either of politics or arts or whatever, but they've just been slightly warped by their time in this city. And both Lee Israel and Jack Hawk feel to me like such New York types. And I love that the movie doesn't take the edges off of them.
Mm.
So that like, Melissa McCarthy, when she gives that speech and say, in many ways, this is the best work of my life, her criminal behavior is the thing that she's most proud of. Like, she doesn't really reform. She actually kind of very cleverly decides, I was engaged in this criminal enterprise. I'm now going to use it to, like, sell my story and make another book about it.
I want to read that book.
Let there be more movies like this. Yes. Sadly, I'm not sure there will be a lot of them. Like, it's incredible that this was not made for television or just released straight to Netflix, like Private Life. Like, the fact that we got to see this in a cinema and then it's gotten so many Oscar nominations is great.
It's great.
Can I ask you one last question? Do you think this is a signal of more great dramatic roles for Melissa McCarthy? And will she get more Oscar nominations?
Yes, she will get more Oscar nominations. I would like to see her not have to do drama to get an Oscar nomination.
Of course, yes, we would like to see more comedic.
I think she had a bit of a slew of flops recently.
Mm.
Like,
she makes a lot of movies.
She makes a lot of movies, but I think the winning streak is actually quite over by now. Even though, like I said a moment ago, I would watch all those films. I just think maybe she'll be like, okay, you know what? No, I am good and bankable and talented. Let's not go into production on this film just yet. Let's make it a bit better.
What's the role that she actually wins an Oscar for?
Spy 2.
We've got to get her teamed up with some amazing European auteur.
How about Lars von Trier?
I was thinking more in the, like, Almodovar type, but that is kind of my answer for everything. Whenever I want someone, some amazing middle-aged woman to win an Oscar, I always decide to pair her with Almodovar.
Who would I put her with, really, though? I would put her with Agnes Varda.
She's got to move quick.
Or Agnieszka Holland.
Is she still around?
She's had a film in the Berlinale, honey.
Very good. Okay. Or maybe she could just keep teaming up with Marielle Heller, because honestly, she's done a great job and unrecognized by the Academy.
Of course.
Boo to them. Speaking of being unrecognized, I think we might have to turn to another film, Sean. Are you ready to gird your loins?
Oh, I'm tucked. I'm absolutely tucked and double tucked ready to talk about this piece of work.
That film is called
The Wife.
You say that with such tension.
Yeah, and you know what? Glenn Close is like, oh, this film took so long to make because it was called The Wife. You know, oh, it just means that women are underrepresented in cinema. I'm like, no, Glenn, because it was called The Wife, which is one of the worst titles for anything ever made, okay? If it was called The Husband, I would equally think it was as boring a piece of shit as this film is.
But, I mean, to be fair, it's called The Wife because it's about the type of woman who is considered to be just the wife.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, yes.
And that
yes.
is its thesis, that those women are worthy of examination and that they have contributed to the achievements of their successful husbands.
Yes, I agree with you on that level, okay? I still think that anything called the wife deserves to be derided, okay?
Well, apparently the novel it's based on by Meg Wolitzer was really acclaimed. It got great reviews in the New York Times and respectable publications. Like, apparently it was very good.
Okay, well, let's talk about the adaptation of this very respected novel, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The plot, the whole characterization and the way the story is structured is dreadful. So we have this woman, Joan Castleman. And the very start of the film, before he receives the call that he's won the Nobel Prize, he is excited and he asks his wife if they can have sex, okay? And they do. Very by the numbers, but significant for people of their age, sex. He's wearing a t-shirt, she's wearing a nightie, but they do all...
Very accurate, if you
they
ask
do
me.
All the thrusting motions that one expects of intercourse. And I'm just sitting there in the cinema in screen one of the Ritzy with about two other people on Friday night, one of them being you. And I think to myself, wow, okay, maybe I had prejudged this film. This is a great start to it. Okay?
Yeah, I mean, the only other place you can find that is Jonathan Pryce's OnlyFans page.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. I don't have to pay him for that.
I'd rather pay for it in a cinema.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So it's looking like it's going to be middle-aged normcore porn.
Yeah, I'm like, this is cool. Okay, let's get into this, okay? Then it cuts, like, first of all, the film looks terrible, okay? I know that at a certain age, all middle-aged people just fill their homes with full of shit, okay? But they have this party with their awful, obnoxious, one-dimensional children in this dreadful, dreary-looking house in Scandinavia or Canada.
No,
or...
it's America.
Okay, it didn't look
it's
like
America. It's Connecticut.
Okay, can I say something? This is also the reason why this film failed. I thought they lived in Scandinavia.
No!
Because nothing about that house or their lives says, we are Americans, okay? They might as well have been Soviet spies, okay, in a training camp for life
okay,
in
sure,
America.
Okay, sure. All right. This is not a podcast entirely of the wife, and I think we've actually talked a bit about the wife already, if you go back, because we watched it around the same time that we were covering Glenn Close and Fatal Attraction. So please go back to that episode in our 1987 series. I didn't like the wife either. I thought the movie was shoddy from beginning to end in many, many ways. Here's my question to you. It is very likely that Glenn Close will win an award for this film, kind of crowning her entire career and finally receiving an Oscar after all these nominations. Will you be upset? Will you be disappointed? And if so, why? Can you talk about the performance?
Not the politics. Listen, I had to vent about the wife at the very start because that's the basis of where my dislike for this
okay.
film and this performance comes from. I have a real, real issue with people winning awards for bad films. Like, listen, I haven't seen Crazy Heart, but I don't particularly care about the men. I don't know if Crazy Heart is good or not, but...
It's actually, Crazy Heart would be a really comparable situation, I would say. Crazy Heart, which I saw on a plane, in my memory, is not a bad film. It's not a great or memorable film, but it is entirely constructed around being a vehicle for what Jeff Bridges does, right? In terms of the Jeff Bridges type persona, he sings, he's laconic, it's all Jeff Bridges. This movie is centered around Glenn and the character of Glenn.
Yeah. Like, this is a podcast about actresses, and you and I care a lot about actresses. It's really typical. This happens time and time again in the best actress category, where you get a film with one nomination that gets an acting award. In fact, it's predictable. You know, we saw it with Charlize Theron in Monster, Julianne Moore in Still Alice. Like, and immediately people started comparing this film to Still Alice, for example. Okay, now I have to really push back on that comparison. Because Still Alice is a complex study of a woman who is losing her life. And also that film was made under great circumstances of great difficulty from the director pair who were making it, Richard Lasseter and Wash Westmoreland. Still Alice has elements in it that I still regularly think about. One of them being the video that she records to herself to tell her how to kill herself should the time come. And how that scene starts over and over again because she keeps forgetting how to do it, okay?
And also the bit where she reads the Elizabeth Bishop poem. I mean, there's tons. Yeah. Still Alice, I can understand the comparison because of this kind of level of the film.
Yeah, then the crowning achievement of one actress's career. So those comparisons were inevitable. But there was something about the wife in every aspect of it, in terms of the characterization both of Joan Castleman, of her husband, of Christian Slater as that skeezy reporter, of her stupid fucking child, okay, in the leather
Max
jacket.
Max Irons.
Terrible. Terrible.
Well, and the worst is all the flashbacks.
Oh my god, the flashbacks are terrible.
With her own daughter as herself, younger.
Yeah.
And then
that guy, so that guy who plays the young Jonathan Pryce also played the young Dennis Thatcher in The Iron Lady.
Has he not aged? Like,
he also happened to be at Oxford at the same time that I was studying there. He's quite cute, but I have to say, if that is your niche, if your niche is playing young versions of middle-aged British character actors in flashback scenes in middling movies, you got a problem.
Okay, so let's talk about Glenn for a second.
Let's talk about Glenn for a while.
Okay, Glenn has had a lot of Oscar nominations. Let's see if I can think of them off the top of my head.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so she had The World According to Garp.
Yeah.
She had the Professional, was that it?
The Natural.
The Natural, okay. So The Natural...
The first three are all supporting.
Okay, so The World According to Garp, The Natural... And what's the third supporting?
Oh, are you warm or do you feel a big...
Chill.
Yeah.
Okay, big chill. Then there was Dangerous Liaisons.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was... Wow! Wait. Then there was Fatal Attraction.
Yes.
Then that's a lot in a very short time.
Yes.
And then you had Albert Nobbs?
Correct.
Was that really
huge gap. Huge gap.
And then this thing. I totally understand that Glenn had plenty of opportunities to win this for quality films that she didn't get it for, okay?
Some of that is filler. I mean, I'm not sure that
I think The Natural is considered filler.
Yeah, she's pointless in that, and the movie is forgettable. I have seen The Natural. But also even, like, The Big Chill. If we were, like, Academy Award winner Glenn Close for The Big Chill, I'm not sure that we would be... think that was right. The two towering performances in that list are
Dangerous Liaisons and Fatal Attraction. Those two are iconic, but she's not, I hate to say it, I hate to do the comparison, she's not Meryl. It's not like you have a bounty of riches of performances to choose from. Even among like other roles she did, she's not nominated for, but those two, they are incredible. And I speak as someone who, when we rewatched Fatal Attraction for the previous series, I hated the movie in terms of what it represents. But Glenn does this absolutely incredible job of making that character, Alex Forrest, somehow repulsive and scary and sympathetic. Like, she's an entire orchestra of human emotion and psychology. She's playing all these different levels at once. And, like, I really think she's phenomenal in that movie. And she's also great, obviously, as the Marquise in Dangerous Liaisons. That role's a bit clearer to understand because she's just like a kind of imperious, chilled dragon lady. So Glenn does deserve. Glenn is one of the great actors working now. I understand why people are going for this.
I understand in theory also.
Right. So when we went in to see The Wife, I don't think either of us expected to say, you know, this is the best movie we're going to see all year.
No, but I did think we expected to be pleasantly surprised and witness a powerhouse performance.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, that first scene really, it sets you up in the wrong path, because you're like, wow, Glenn's getting finger-banged in the first 5 minutes of this movie. She still got it.
So what do you think the additions of what aspects would have made this movie better? Like, what, fix the recipe for me. Put in a bit more of what you would have needed.
Okay, well, first of all, I hate to say it, it just needs better direction. Like, mm-hmm. it feels like the set's about to fall down at every point, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a massive sense of artificiality for the entire picture.
Mm-hmm.
That really took me out of the film, to be mm-hmm. quite honest with you. I think there needed to probably be fewer flashbacks, really?
Well, the flashbacks really over-literalize everything. Like, okay, like, spoilers if you haven't seen The Wife. The big reveal is that she wrote his books, okay? And when I say she wrote his books, like, she actually sat down and wrote them, like, in a room with a typewriter while he was doing something else. And, like, that's to me, like, the thing about the whole conception of the movie that's just a bit too obvious. If it had been more like it was a complicated collaboration where she edited his books and did a lot of the writing, you know what I mean? That would actually have been more interesting than how they actually depict it.
Or, for instance, like, she starts off by editing his stories, and then over the years, it gets to one particular point where she writes a whole book, and maybe...
Well, that is actually how they did it.
But what I mean is that, like, say his greatest work of all. Say, for example, he's a good author, okay? And he has one or two books that are just
phenomenal,
phenomenal, head and shoulders above the rest, okay? And that, you know, whenever anyone mentions Mr. Castleman, mm-hmm. they're like, yeah, that one's good, but oh my god, have you read The Seven Stages of Women? You know? Like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I just think that, first of all, the film makes Joan Castleman seem like a superwoman, okay?
Right.
A superwoman and a martyr at the same time.
In what way?
Well, it's like, oh, she had all these children, she wrote all these books, she didn't get any credit for anything.
And she also seems to, like, the way they treat her at the beginning, it's like she organizes the plane travel, and she also, like, knows where his coat is, and, like, she kind of...
taking your medicine.
Yeah, she kind of keeps this befuddled man in line, and you think, okay... You know, she does handle a lot. She's like his manager, right? And she also, there are the kids. She raised the kids. But then we learn that in the midst of doing all that, she also, like, literally sat down at the typewriter and wrote all the books.
Now,
and there's, like, a scene where the boy wants to spend time with his mother, and they're like, oh, in the flashback, we have to close the door because mummy's having some time by herself. And it's literally like, do you know how long it takes to write books? Like,
ages.
Like, what was fucking Jonathan Pryce doing all that time?
I hope he was... ironing. That's what I hope he was doing.
But it seems like he wasn't from the way that...
Now, can I draw a parallel to Colette?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Go ahead.
Now, Colette is a film in which...
directed by Washington.
Where the woman actually wrote everything.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But in that film, the dynamic between Willie and Colette is strangely believable. You think, you watch the trailer and you think, oh, this horrible man locked her up, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you watch it and you think, wow... he's nasty and she's impetuous. They're both talented. They both
and
love each other.
They turn each other
and
on.
They turn each other on.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, actually, no, Colette kind of does need Willie a little bit because the infrastructure in this time does not allow her to... Whatever.
Yeah, but then she needs to break away from him. The movie depicts that in all its complicated stages.
Okay. Colette is more complicated than the wife. Okay.
Yeah.
So why does the wife make everything seem like a much more gargantuan story to believe?
First of all, Colette is based on real events. Right? I mean, that really did happen.
Yeah.
So there's biographical points that we can go to and we can start to depict. It does take place in the 19th century, or no, the early 20th century, coming out of the 19th century. Do you know what I mean? Like, social and sexual mores are different. I would have liked to see a version of the movie that was almost like a chamber drama that was just Glenn Close and Jonathan Pryce kind of hashing out everything. Like, maybe this should have been a play... with two characters alone in a hotel room, like, on the night before he gives the speech. And then some of the suspension of disbelief or artificiality of it, you might have bought into it more because of the intensity of just the focus of them, with no flashbacks, but them, like, rehashing through things, you know? As it's done, we get so much boring time with, like, them going from place to place with, like, the Swedish Academy and stuff. And, like, people who like Glenn's performance seem to like... her chilly, controlled quality through all that. She's kind of like harboring secrets and harboring like resentments that are so deep, deep, deep down. And there's kind of just like stillness as she kind of stands there rigid. And Glenn does rigid, like better than anybody.
Oh yeah, she does.
No, she does. Like with that, with those face, or like, you know, when you
that
think Dangerous Liaisons, it's like she's literally wearing a kabuki mask. And that's why Alex Forrest is so interesting, because she's so much more mercurial. It's quite different from the... I mean, Glenn is essentially a kabuki performer. Think about it. Cruella de Vil, Dangerous Liaisons, and even, you know, Albert Nobbs. She just, like, kind of... her face is, like, fixed in this kind of mask that, like, doesn't let people in.
You know, I'm glad you brought up Albert Nobbs, Brian.
Albert Nobbs is a bizarre film.
We had to turn it off.
Well, I did watch it once, like, long ago when it first came out, but then I wanted you to see it, and you couldn't even get through it.
Yeah, I think I was distracted by your beauty.
I think we
made love.
Oh, I'm sure. You know, definitely, Irish tobacconist shops has always been your fetish.
Actually, it was Jane McTeer's big knockers that just really pushed me over there. No, but I want to say something about Albert Nobbs, okay?
Yeah.
Bear with me.
I'm listening.
Albert Nobbs is the Iraq War.
What?
Okay. Albert Nobbs was an unsuccessful folly into territory in which one person thought that they were going to get something out of it, okay?
And it violated all international norms.
Yeah, and it didn't go well, okay? Now, because Glenn did not win an Oscar for Albert Nobbs, which in itself was a bad idea, okay, that created a vacuum, okay? It created a vacuum in her filmography in which she thought, no, 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 I get one more shot at this, and I'm going to use whatever extreme forces possible. And so what I'm saying is that the wife is Isis.
Oh my God, is this ever going to stop? So what you're saying is we have to have a massive military buildup right now and award her every single award, or the movies are just going to deteriorate. They're just going to get worse and worse.
Oh, yes.
More naked attempts to win an Oscar until, you know, the whole Middle East is in flames. Is that what you're saying, basically?
Essentially, yes.
You know what? I really hope Annette Bening isn't listening to this. Because, you know, every middle-aged actress is now going to try this shock and awe tactic.
That's what it is. It is a shock and awe Oscar campaign. And, like, listen, it was a big relief to me that Annette Bening didn't get an Oscar nomination for Film Stars of Night in Liverpool.
Yeah.
Because it was a bad film.
She wasn't bad in it.
She was way more interesting in that film than Glenn is in this. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I agree. I don't want us to sound like we're Glenn bashing. No. Because, among other things, a nice trait of this award season has actually been Glenn's speeches and, like, just seeing Glenn again out and about, you know, not housebound.
I know that she will not be the first actress who's won an Oscar for the wrong film.
Right.
I know that, okay? I guess I just feel that Oscar-winning performances should come from films that merit them.
But even so, like, do you think she is bad in this movie?
I don't think she's good enough. No, I don't. I think if the material was better, she would be better. I really do.
When I ask you to think about the movie visually or emotionally, is there any moment that you remember?
The moments that I remember are her just, you know, trudging from room to room.
And kind of sighing and being like, oh, you've left your sweater lying on the bed.
Okay, imagine this, okay? I've thought about this. Imagine there's a scene. It's okay, first of all, the lighting is totally different in my version, okay? Uh-huh. It's much colder, it's much darker, okay? It's much more natural. She's alone in a hotel room.
Uh-huh.
She sees one of his books lying on the bed, okay?
Uh-huh.
She sees one of his books. We look at there's a shot directly at the book.
Uh-huh.
Book, Glenn's face. She picks it up, and she opens it up, and it says, "To my darling wife, Joan," okay? And she looks at the book and she just rips the page out. Okay? Could you imagine that? Okay, I'm not a screenwriter or a director.
Okay.
But that scene is great.
I mean, it could still be workshopped a bit more. But, like, okay, when I think of the movie that we did actually get, here's elements I like about it, which is not still to say that it's great. That scene where she goes out for a drink with Christian Slater, I'm not saying it's a great scene. I like that she has almost this, like, flirtatious quality in the way that she kind of opens up with liquor and kind of talks to him.
And cigarettes.
She's been so clenched and kind of withdrawn, yeah? I also vividly remember in the actual banquet scene where they're being awarded the prize and he mentions her in the speech, where she just stands up from the table and there's that tracking shot as she kind of, like,
that's good,
angrily and difficultly, like, walks away. Like, that to me, there's something about feeling like, what has my whole life become? Like, even my request to not be acknowledged is now being thrown in my face by this person who I have been complicit in my own self-erasure. It gets interesting, but it just never lands with the emotional heft that it needs to. Because, okay, I have to admit, when I saw it, people had set me up that, like, the movie was a bit of a slow burn and it was going to kind of really pay off. So I thought, oh, she's leaving the banquet. Like, here it comes. It's going to be this incredible climactic scene where all the fireworks happen. And then that scene back in the hotel room is just terrible, because that's where the unbelievability of the whole thing just comes out. You're like, have they never had this discussion over all the decades that she's writing the book? Do these people even seem like people who write books?
No.
And this is the problem with maybe changing it from a novel into a film. It's like, they can't sit down and talk about the writing process or, like, what the books are actually about. They've just got to kind of, like, throw them around the room and scream at each other.
So the book as well, well liked, isn't it?
I guess so. And maybe in a book you can get inside someone's internal monologue or their kind of self-perception in a way that this movie you can't. And I'm sure whatever's going on in Glenn's head is very interesting as we watch her kind of glacial, you know, close-ups. But it just doesn't translate into drama effectively.
Agreed.
Do you think this is Glenn's last nomination?
Yes.
This is the end of Glenn?
Yes.
Well, I'm sure, you know, illegal wars and terrorist groups will be springing up in different actresses' careers.
I mean, to draw a parallel to Hillary, it's like, give her what she needs so she doesn't do it again.
Well, speaking of people whose careers are only at the very beginning, at least in terms of acting, the last nominated performance that we have yet to discuss is a young upstart named Stephanie Germanotta.
Who?
You know her. You know her. She's a lady. She's that funny lady. You know her. You know who I'm talking about. She's funny.
Yes, I do.
She's a funny lady named Gaga, Funny Gaga, and she has had her big screen breakthrough. Now, Sean, you are, is it fair to say, a Gaga stan?
No, not a stan. I'm a big fan.
Okay, big fan. Would you consider yourself a little monster? No. Or medium-sized monster?
Actually, I'm not even going to take away the big fan. I'm a qualified fan of Lady Gaga.
But you've been studying her musical career.
I know most of the lyrics to most songs, except anything from Born This Way. I don't know.
How about Joanne?
Joanne I listen to a fair bit. Born This Way, I don't like.
So you're more of a Gaga aficionado than I am, who only knows the hits, yeah?
I can sing art pop from art pop.
You were saying to me recently that there was a podcast on Slate focusing on her music that really gave you a new appreciation for her and kind of her whole scope
of what
she's
done. Well, I would say it didn't give me a new appreciation, but what it did was it bolstered the appreciation I already had and made me want to, like, you know, root for her a bit more.
For people listening who want to know a bit more, The Hit Parade, which is my new official favourite podcast from Slate, has an excellent episode about Lady Gaga and just details how long in the making this opportunity was for her.
Well, yeah, and it's also because that podcast really puts it in the context. I mean, let's forget about Janet Gaynor for a while. I haven't seen the 37 Stars Born, but I have obviously seen Judy, and I've seen Barbara. We did an episode on it.
Yeah.
And it really is, like, Lady Gaga is the person to be doing this role when those two are the previous ones who've held it, right? It's not Beyoncé.
It's not Madonna.
No, it's probably not Madonna. Because Lady Gaga has that same, I don't know, Judy and Barbara are immensely talented, great singers, but they're also gawky, awkward outsiders who are both stars and people who have this kind of pain and vulnerability about them. Barbara maybe more so when she was younger. She's kind of become a kind of parody of herself.
Lion face parody of herself.
But, like, you know, their talent is undeniable, all three of them. And yet there's this chip on their shoulder of kind of never being acknowledged quite in the right way, or being as beautiful as anyone else, or kind of, like, you know,
as glamorous or sexy. Actually, let's be honest, sexy.
This is a movie star performance.
Yeah.
And, like, from the beginning, from the opening of Ally in that cubicle at the restaurant, like, screaming in the toilet to the guy on the phone. Do you remember that?
Of course I remember that.
Yeah. And then coming out and being in her little waitress outfit with gorgeous Ramon, or whatever his name was. What was his name? The cute little...
Ramon!
The gay little friend. I loved him. He was cute.
He was cute.
Yeah. So, talk us through. What do you think Lady Gaga deserved this nomination, and if so, why?
Oh, absolutely. She deserved it exclusively and solely to prove people wrong.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Meaning what?
Meaning she didn't just come to Southwest General to be a nurse. She came to Southwest General to settle an old score, okay?
Oh my God.
That's what she's done in this film.
Meaning what? And an old score with whom?
With everybody who said she was never going to be a star, and everyone who said she was never going to be famous.
Well, but here's the thing. She was already a star, and she was already famous. She was not a movie actress.
Yeah, but this is her story. Being in drag bars and piano bars and hauling her keyboard, you know, up down from the Bronx to the other end of Manhattan. Basically being a workhorse.
Yeah.
And everybody now having a clue what to do with her for so long. Like, I love her so much. I really do.
Have you always?
I've loved her since day one. 6 months before Just Dance was number one in the US charts.
Okay, no, I know. I know you love all this, but you also love Madonna as a musical performer. It doesn't mean you love her on-screen acting all the time. So that love that you have for her as a pop star, how has that translated into performing and this performance?
Well, in this film,
yes,
she's very good. Now, do I think she'd be good in another film? Well, I don't know.
She's very natural in this film.
But again, she's natural because this is a territory in which she... It's singing, which is a world she knows, and it's being plucked from obscurity, which she kind of understands.
Agreed, but here's a point that I think is to her credit, yeah? She's not known for being natural.
No, she's known for being massively artificial.
Exactly,
and
even... What was the name of that Netflix documentary?
5'2".
Okay, so in 5'2", she's actually playing herself.
And she's bad.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
Okay, and actually, here we go. Okay, this is interesting.
Well, if you're going to say it, Brian, of course it's interesting.
No, you're going to like this. So Madonna has tried to be an actress and not always been very good. I recently saw Desperately Seeking Susan, and she's great in that. But in a lot of other things, she just seems like out of her depth. When is Madonna, though, actually her best on screen?
Well, it's in Truth or Dare, of course.
Incredible, right? So Madonna is most classically Madonna when she's actually just being herself in a documentary. Gaga, with all her artificiality and her costumes and her meat dress and her everything that she does.
Don't forget her chronic pain.
When she's being herself, I've never really bought it.
Yeah.
But what she then does is she's kind of most herself in a fictional construct as Ally Maine. I literally was like, here's a Long Island girl. Andrew Dice Clay is her father. She's Italian-American. She's schlepping around her keyboard. She's doing her stuff. Yes, it's a version of herself, but she's actually being an actress in a way that Madonna can't do.
Yeah. The day that these Oscar nominations were announced and that her name was called out, not only did she surpass Streisand by getting nominated for song and actress in the same year, she also surpassed Madonna in a way that Madonna is never going to be able to do.
Well, Madonna is the greater cultural influence and the greater pop star.
Madonna is the greater... yes.
No, she's the greater pop star.
Yeah, history will show that she is, but
I mean, unless Lady Gaga has a career that lasts for 30 more years.
Which I think she will.
Maybe.
I genuinely think she will.
Unless she moves into... I mean, I would say actually the comparison with Lady Gaga now may be more to Cher.
Well, this is a thing that people have talked about, is that she seems... She always used to say that she always wanted to be an actress before she was a singer, but singing kind of caught on first.
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, like Ally Maine, people liked her voice, but they didn't like the way she looked, so acting wasn't a thing for her to do.
Mm-hmm.
And there is kind of chatter that this Oscar nomination signals a departure from the music and more into acting. When I think of Gaga, I think of completely immersed in every aspect of what she's doing, okay? From costumes to songs to songwriting to producing to concerts to everything. She is her own creation. And I kind of find the idea of her moving away from that into being a actor in a film, which mm-hmm. is a massively collaborative experience with one other person who puts a button on it, who's the director. Like, I just don't know if she's truly cut out for that, because she wants the world, and film only gives you a portion of that.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see, because obviously she clearly lucked out on an incredible collaborator in Bradley Cooper.
Yes.
Who would have thunk it? Like, Bradley Cooper...
Oh my God, do you remember all the chatter that this film was going to be a total flop?
Yeah. And it's not been a flop, and it's been critically well-received. Yeah. I mean, obviously, it's not done as well with the Oscar nominations as they thought, so something's slightly gone askew in their narrative. But, you know, it's not a flop financially. The soundtrack is selling, and they both came out looking really great in it. But what I'm saying is, like, she lucked out with him, not just because he directed it well and he turned out to be good, but they clearly have a bond. Like, the chemistry between them is, like, on the level of the chemistry between Richard E. Grant and Melissa McCarthy. Would you agree? I guess what I'm saying is, like, A Star Is Born has never felt, in any of the versions, like a real romance. You know, do you really believe that Judy Garland and James Mason are in love? No. It's a weird story about two sort of damaged narcissists who enjoy each other's company.
Yeah, and who we enjoy a lot for the first hour. In every version.
They feel like they're going to give something to one another, and then one sucks the life force out of the other one, and then the other one dies, and the first one is sad. And, like, this is why the Streisand version is weird, because they actually try to make the relationship between her and Chris Christopherson... Esther Hoffman and Chris Christopherson sexy, which Chris is sexy, Barbara is doing her best at being sexy, but, like, you're still always like, this isn't really a love story that I really care about. And I think what's nice about Cooper and Gaga, they just seem like they're nice to each other and they're looking out for each other. They don't really strike... It's not like a passion.
But that's what disappoints me a bit. I really wanted to believe that there was heat between the characters in these pictures. There was zero heat between Judy and
James Mason
for a variety of reasons. I think there's something to be said when the Streisand Christopherson version actually has more sexiness in retrospect than we first realized.
But
Like you know, you also, you remember you see Lady Gaga's, I think you looked down for at one point. Did you look down during
this?
No,
you always say, did you look down when someone flashes their tits?
She had tits and her and vagine in the scene. Did you not see that? I think you must have, like, blinked or something.
I guess. I'm always blinking or looking down.
Tits, did you see her breasts and her vagine?
I don't remember at all. But
well, I would.
Okay,
I would,
anyway, what's your point?
Like, you know, she also does full frontal nudity in it, which I respect.
Great, but what I'm saying is the chemistry between them, yes, it's not the heat of passion of sexuality, it's the heat of writing that song together, which creativity. Now, granted, they didn't really write it, but, like, you feel this rush of them writing the thing and her coming out on the stage and then them just kind of, like, raising each other up, yeah? And, in fact, that is exactly what happened with Bradley in his directorial debut and Lady Gaga in her big screen breakthrough. They're both helping each other out. They're giving one another a boost.
Yeah.
And that's why the movie has so much goodwill going for it. We've not talked a lot about any specific moments from Gaga's performance. I mean, vocally, she's great. I actually quite like early on in the movie when she's very cagey about his attentions. Like, he's kind of touching her and saying, can I take off this eyelash and all this stuff? And she's just kind of looking at him like, I don't want to get hurt by this guy. This guy is like a big megastar and I'm a nobody. Do you know what I mean? I kind of love her resistance to all that.
Well, that's because we're so used to seeing her as a big superstar and seeing her act like the way we would.
Yeah.
It's total human empathy.
And I mean, it's before she gets that hair, body, face.
Yes.
Your favorite song from the film.
My favorite, absolute favorite song from
so
the film.
So if I cry during Shallow, do you cry during Hair, Body, Face by Diane Warren?
Oh, I weep. I sob.
Now, what do you think is happening on Oscar night when Gaga and Diane Warren run into each other?
She's going to say, better live next time, Diane.
But they work together. Didn't Diane write that Gaga song?
I think she wrote loads of them, in fact.
But didn't she write that one from the previous time?
Why'd you come in here with an ass like
that? Not that one. The one from the documentary.
Oh, yeah, it's That Happens to You.
Yeah. Didn't Diane Warren write that with her?
She may have, yeah.
Yeah, so obviously they know each other. but, I mean, talk about overdue Oscars.
Oh my god, poor
Diane
woman.
Warren.
Now, who did Diane Warren piss off?
Why didn't...
Maybe Diane Warren is a horrible person.
Why didn't Glenn get Diane Warren to write a song for the wife? That would have been a narrative.
And give Glenn a writing credit.
Exactly. It worked so well with Albert Dobbs.
Yeah.
What would the song, the Diane Warren song from the wife have been?
It would be called Theme from the Wife.
It would have been Emerging from the Shadows, parentheses, Theme from the Wife. I've lived so long in the shadows. Can't you hear it? You can hear it.
Or how about Walnut, parentheses, a Theme from the Wife.
Wait, what's Walnut?
Were you not paying attention to the film? The stupid fucking walnut that he pulls out as a means of flirting with people?
Oh, yeah, that was like the name of his book too, wasn't it? The Walnut.
Yes.
Nobel Prize. Yes, indeed.
I wrote this page and this book and all of these things.
All right. We don't begrudge you, Glenn. You should have won for Cruella de Vil. You should have won for Alex Forrest.
Who are you voting for?
If I had a vote, I think it would be Melissa McCarthy. And you?
Definitely Glenn Close.
Shut up! Come on!
It's Melissa McCarthy. Yeah. So, let me rank them, okay?
Yeah.
My first vote goes to Melissa McCarthy.
Mm-hmm.
My second vote goes to Olivia Colman.
Mm-hmm.
My third vote goes to Yalitza. My fourth vote goes to Lady Gaga, and fifth place is Glenn Close. Sorry,
wow.
That's just the way I see it.
I think I would have some swapping around with the last three. Maybe Gaga and Yalitza might switch in there. Because I think people forget that singing is actually part of the movie. It's not just like she only acts when she's doing the acting. Like, actually, the singing is really important.
Yeah, that's why you're number four.
It's 4 out of 5.
Yeah.
Anyway, Gaga's going to win Best Song. Glenn will likely win Best Actress, and who can really begrudge it, you know? I mean, Glenn has put in her dues. Let's remember, she sat in the wings with your least favorite person, Donald Sutherland, through that entire 2002
Enemy Awards
ceremony, whatever it was.
Remember? I think you should play it right now.
This is the first Oscar for Halle Berry. She garnered rave reviews in 1999 for her Enemy Emmy Award-winning performance in the lead in introducing Dorothy Dandridge.
A classic, one of the greatest hits. You know, she had to do that. She had to give that Oscar to Deborah Carr and sit there thinking, I'm soon going to surpass this woman for nominations and no wins.
She had to sing Losing My Mind in front of...
Meryl. And Barbara Cook.
Who neither of them were impressed. She would be.
I know. So, you know, in some way, it's a shame that Glenn has never played Hillary Clinton. Because I think, actually, if they ever did a film of What Happened... Which, let's be honest, there might be an HBO movie coming down the pike.
Is that speculation, or is
it's
that...
I don't know anything about it, but I could imagine someone would do it. If they did Game Change about Sarah Palin, there's clearly, at some point, gotta be a Trump versus Hillary TV movie.
Maybe in a few years, though, once the dust settles.
But wouldn't you think Glenn would actually be quite good? Isn't she about the right age?
Yeah, she is the right age, but she's not the right chin for the role.
You love Glenn in Reversal of Fortune. So
oh my God, I love her.
Pretend that she's winning for Reversal of Fortune. Just when she's up there, just say, Von Bülow.
She didn't get nominated for that, did she?
She didn't. Von Bülow. Von Bülow.
Okay.
Are you excited to watch the Oscars this year, Sean?
Not really, no, but I'll watch them anyway.
Oh, come on, there's going to be some exciting upsets. There's going to be something exciting's going to happen. Yeah. Spike Lee, we're rooting for
the
you.
The set will just collapse. Or
Nicole Holofcener, we're rooting for you.
Oh, we are,
Yeah. There's a lot of people we're rooting for this year.
Yeah, we're rooting for Irish film The Favourite.
Yeah, a bunch of things. We're excited.
We are excited.
Yeah,
but okay. You know what we are? We're tired.
Gosh, we're doing a podcast again. Ladies and gentlemen, it's nice to be back talking about our favorite subject. If you haven't subscribed, please do subscribe. Do you know why? Because then when we start doing new episodes again, you'll be the first to know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And dive into the treasure trove of quality that is our backup.
Yeah, we've already referenced a few of the episodes. There's a whole bunch about Oscar seasons past, 1987. There's Good, Bad, Crazy of many of the people we've already talked about. It goes way, way, way back.
Yeah. So, Brian, how can they find us?
You can find us on Twitter at Broad Appeal Pod. I am at VA Mullen Speaks.
And I'm at Sean McGovern X.
Please rate and, you know, leave a review for the podcast on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Spotify.
Yeah.
Where you can also find the Star is Born soundtrack and us side by side.
Maybe on the one playlist. Who knows?
Johnny, you will always be my little gold man. Short form.
Oh, thanks, babe. And you will always be my war horse.
That was incredibly loud and extremely close. What is it? I don't know.
That's it.
Extremely loud. Oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.